Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Interoperability Standards Workgroup. I'm Mike Berry, I'm with ONC, and we are glad that you could join us today. We do have a few guest presenters with us today, and I'd like to welcome and thank them for their participation. All our workgroup meetings are open to the public, and your feedback is welcomed, which could be typed in the Zoom chat feature throughout the meeting, or could be made verbally during the public comment period that is scheduled at about 11:55 Eastern Time this morning. I'd like to begin roll call of our work group members. So when I call your name, please indicate if you are here. And I'll start with our co-chairs, Sarah DeSilvi.
I am here.
Nerys Sundar-Rajan.
I'm here. Good morning.
Pooja Babra is absent today. She'll be joining us next week. Shai LeBlend. Ricky Bloomfield.
Good morning.
Hans Butenbeck. Tina Caraballo is also unable to join us today, but she'll be back next week.
Hans. Double mute.
Oh, hi, Hans.
Sorry.
Thank you. Grace Cordovana.
Good morning.
Raj Dash.
Good morning.
Steve Eichner.
Good morning.
Nidra Garrett.
Good morning.
Raj Gopharti. Bryant Thomas Karras. Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Tom Wu.
Good morning.
Meg Marshall.
Hi, good morning.
Anna McAllister. Glenn McDonald.
I'm here.
Good morning.
Thank you, Anna. Good morning, Clem. Devin McGraw.
Present, good morning.
Aaron Meary. Aaron Neinstein.
Good morning, I'm here.
AK Lamo Ocean Kenton.
Good morning, I'm here.
Mark Savage.
Good morning.
Michelle Schreiber. Shelley Spira.
Good morning.
And Ram Sharam.
Good morning.
Good morning to all, and thank you. And now please join me in welcoming Sarah and Nerys for their opening remarks.
Good morning, Mike. I'm here as well.
Thanks, Brian.
Welcome, everybody. It's Nerys and my honor to welcome you all to this conversation today. We are going to be continuing our deep dive of certain data elements with subject matter experts. Very grateful for Terrence O'Malley, Holly Miller, and Mario Moen to come and talk about treatment interventions, preferences, and care experience preferences. After that time, we hope to do a focus on some of those residual USCDI V4 elements. We may be able to address physical activity. That was one of the elements we were hoping to revisit. It looks like Al solved the problem on the share drive. But we do want to make sure that we look into those level two data elements as much as we can and start addressing those. A note, I will be leaving early to switch to presenting at a CMS webinar, but Nerys will be here for the entire time. Next slide, please. Next slide. Just a grounding again on our charge. We making great headway again, almost fully examined the full set of draft USAID V4 elements and looking forward to leaning into level two data classes. Again, very appreciative of our subject matter experts who come into this meeting to help us understand some of the subtleties of those draft USCID 4 elements. And we had guests last week. We have subject matter experts again today, and then look forward again next week to having some colleagues again talking about facilities information from the CDC CMS. Next slide, please. This is our status. Again, everything in green has been completed with full consensus agreement by the ISWG. The elements of, it looks like we do have to revisit physical activity, I think, for a final disposition. It's green here, but we have some revisiting to do on some of these elements, like such as wrapping up alcohol use and substance use, average blood pressure, et cetera. We do have our colleagues working on the medication instructions and adherence. Pooja, I don't believe, is able to be here today, but they will be coming back to present next week. And again, we're doing a deep dive on the treatment and intervention preferences and care experience preferences today. So we're well on our path to completing our primary charge in order to get that final recommendation to HITAC by the early April. Next slide, please. And it's now my honor to allow our presenters for the first part of our conversation on treatment intervention preferences and care experience preferences to Terry O'Malley and Holly Miller, well known to this group and to HITAC and ISWG in the past. We already know their mics work, so I'm going to pass the mic to Terry and Holly.
Thank you so much, Sarah, and good morning. We're honored to be invited to present to you today regarding goals, preferences, and priorities, which Terry and I will refer to going forward as GPPs. We greatly appreciate your interest in this subject, as we believe that it is a critical aspect of patient-centered care. As such, this information should be captured and regularly updated by the individual, made accessible to the care team, and always be transmitted as part of a transition of care document that accompanies the individual across care environments. This is a subject that is very easy to relate to, as all of us either are patients or will be eventually. I'm sure we all want our own treatment, care, and quality of life preferences recorded and respected. We strongly agree with the importance of the proposed GPPs for treatment and care. We believe these additions to USCDI are consistent with ONC's policy goals and do not impose a significant burden on providers or developers. We are, however, proposing for your consideration a third GPP data element in addition to treatment and care, which is equally important to patient-centered care, that of quality of life. To give you some background, Dr. O'Malley and I have been working for some time on developing an essential long-term post-acute care transition of care data set. GPPs naturally fall into this work. To validate our assumptions regarding essential elements for this data set, we gave a presentation in October of 2022 at the Leading Age Summit. During our presentation, we polled approximately 40 audience members to determine the data elements they felt were essential or not necessary for a skilled nursing facility to know in advance of an admission. We personalized it by asking them what they would want the skilled nursing facility to know if they or a loved one were to be imminently admitted. Please, next slide, please. The results you see summarized on this slide. The data elements fell into three buckets: GPPs for treatment, care, and quality of life. GPPs for treatment and care have LOINT codes. However, there's no value set for the codes as they are documented in the patient's own words. Stay tuned on this as Terry will discuss remarkable work in progress to develop these value sets. To be clear, we're considering preferences for treatment as those interventions the individual does or does not want in general and specifically at end of life. Preferences for care deals with the setting of care and who is providing the care rather than the content of the care itself. For example, preferring to have care delivered in one's home rather than in a facility, or preferences to have culturally sensitive care such as those required for a variety of religious practices. Preferences for quality of life defines what is important to the individual to enhance the meaning and value of their life. As you can see on the slide, the frequency of essential responses varied from 100% for code status with treatment preferences to 6% for cultural norms with care preferences. In our small group of respondents, the vast majority felt that the proposed treatment preferences were essential, whereas among care preferences, only the element understanding expectations for the SNF stay was deemed essential by the majority of the group, with caregiver preference and culturally sensitive care deemed not necessary by the large majority. Finally, every element of quality of life, the majority of the group felt these elements to be essential, with nap time, very surprisingly, privacy, autonomy, socialization, and meal choices ranked highest. We found these responses fascinating and they surprised us. The things that are important to note are that this is an extremely limited sample, 40 participants in a conference. So our results certainly are not definitive. However, it does demonstrate that this group raised a wide range of issues, even though it was a small sample. Larger population samples are needed to validate the LTPAC dataset and would no doubt identify more issues. A coded location where treatment and care preferences can reside within the electronic health record with the addition of these data elements to USCDI is an excellent start, particularly as we've discussed how essential it is that these data are available to the care team and move with the individual across care transitions. Importantly for your committee, this study supports the choice of preferences for treatment and care. However, it also supports additionally adding to the USCDI quality of life preferences. As previously discussed, currently there's not a standardized value set for the LOINC codes for treatment, care, or quality of life. However, Terry is now going to continue and describe the exciting work within the Moving Forward Coalition of implementing the recommendations of the 2022 National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, or NASEM report on the imperative to improve nursing home quality, which includes building a standardized value set for GPPs. Terry?
Thank you, Holly, and thank you to the committee. And my vote goes for nap time for quality of life. So I'd like to give you an example of how these data elements are going to be put to use in the Moving Forward Coalition. So Moving Forward came together in response to the 2022 NASEM report. And our last slide, don't advance yet, has a link to that report, as well as a couple of other links that you may find useful. So the report made seven sets of recommendations, including patient-centered care, specifically aligning care to the individual's goals and preferences. It also called for financial transparency, rational financing, quality improvement, quality measurement, staffing upgrades, and health information technology deployment. Greg Alexander, who's a nurse and a PhD professor at Columbia School of Nursing, and I co-chair Committee 7, the HIT Deployment Committee, and one of our work groups is working at how we can collect GPP data efficiently in greater detail and then use this more granular data to inform care. And as a final step, we want a process that can measure whether the care provided aligns with the individual's GPP. Maria Moen, who's going to follow us, and whose work you've already seen and is a leader in making all this happen, also co-chairs this work group. So good. Next slide, please. So this slide outlines the model that Moving Forward is using to measure the concordance of the care provided to the individual with the individual's GPP. It's a three-step process. So step one in blue is the current process in nursing homes to create a care plan, which then determines the care provided. The individual's GPP are fed into the care planning process. So we are going to add two more steps to this process. Step two, in red, involves comparing the individual's GPP with the care provided to see if they align. The alignment measure requires the individual to answer affirmatively that the care provided addressed their priorities in a way that was acceptable to them to achieve outcomes that they valued. That is our definition of concordance of care provided and goals. In the event the care is not concordant, then step three in green kicks in and leads to a reassessment of GPPs, a revision of the care plan, and the cycle starts again. Our hope is to make this process easily repeatable so that care is frequently assessed and realigned with GPPs. So although Moving Forward is focused on nursing homes, the process of measuring concordance is applicable in every setting where care is provided. There's a huge benefit to creating a standardized set of GPP data elements and making them available wherever the individual receives care. So our work group for GPP includes subject matter experts as well as nursing home residents, staff, and owners. We are starting with the task of assembling a taxonomy of GPP, which in turn will help us create an HIT-enabled process to collect those data efficiently. This work group has obtained permission with the help of Maria and also has gotten IRB approval to analyze 10,000 de-identified advanced directive records using natural language processing. The company providing the records, AD Vault, stores over 200,000 advanced directives from many companies. This is an incredible and potentially groundbreaking work that we're undertaking. We plan to create a taxonomy based on how individuals in this sample have expressed their GPP for treatment and care. We expect that many of the answers will also address more general issues of quality of life as well. So we plan to supplement this list with other GPP profiles, such as the Eden Alternative, for which there's a link on the final slide. Of note, the nursing home residents on this work group have already stated that taxonomy must include quality of life preferences in addition to preferences for care and treatment. And as Holly noted, because transitions of care are such an important use case, we're in the process of proposing to CMS that they establish standards for transitions of care that address timeliness of data availability, data usability, and data completeness. And in our opinion, goals, preferences, and priorities for treatment, care, and quality of life are essential components of a complete transitions of care data set. So in summary, both the projects that Dr. Miller and I discussed have uncovered a range of goals, preferences, and priorities, and they fall into three buckets: end-of-life treatment preferences, preferences for ongoing care, and preferences for quality of life. So we applaud your work to add goals, preferences, and priorities for treatment and care to USCDI. It is essential and long overdue. We respectfully request you consider adding goals, preferences, and priorities for quality of life as well. Thank you for your kind intervention. And your kind invitation, and our remarks are done. Thank you.
Thank you so much for this very important presentation, Holly and Terry, and for your longstanding engagement with this work on a national level. Usually what we do is open up questions. Are you all able to stay through Maria's presentation? Should we group questions at the end? How long are you with us to respect your time?
I'm good until after 10:30. That's fine. Or after 11:30.
Sarah, I'm able to stay as well.
Okay, perfect. And so it does seem reasonable to move forward with Maria's presentation and then have collective conversation after the fact. Thank you so much for being able to stay with us. Now, grateful for Maria presenting on the same topic from her expert perspective. Maria? Is Maria with us? I do not see Maria. She might have dropped. And so what we're going to do is respecting the fact that we just did have a very brilliant presentation and waiting for Maria to come back. We might be able to take questions from the ISWG. Any questions for Holly and Terry? Mark?
Thanks very much, and thanks so much for the presentation. I wanted to raise a couple of the points that I had noted in the work group discussion. One is just to confirm that while the submission for this data element was framed around advanced directives, I think the presentation we just heard acknowledges that there could be many sources of information about preferences, and that we're really working with a data element that is works with the definition, and it doesn't look at advanced directives as being the only source of truth or the only source of information to complete the value sets. That's correct. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yep, absolutely.
Great.
Good observation.
Second thing I wanted to check about is how this might, how a person's response about preferences might intersect with a personal representative's or a power of attorneys for healthcare's statements about representatives. I'm going to guess that this may not be the data element to sort that out, but it does, and rather it leads me to raise something that the work group has been discussing actually last year and this year, which is the importance of having a provenance and author data element so that we know who is making, who is providing the value if we need to sort that out at some point. So maybe the open-ended question should be, how does this, in your minds, how does this data element work when a person has specified a value, but then a personal representative who's coming in later and may have to make the call might specify something different?
Holly, let me take that one. Okay.
Please, Terry.
That's an incredibly important point because in nursing facilities, about half of the individuals have cognitive impairment, half of the residents. And so to some degree, they can advance their own goals, preferences, and priorities, but often rely on a proxy. And the more advanced the cognitive impairment is, the more important the proxy becomes. And so having that provenance, I think, is going to be essential. So let me agree 100% with your proposal. And it's going to be a real challenge to get people's goals, preferences, and priorities from a secondhand source. And I guess that source, however, is the only source available. So that's probably as good as we're going to get.
Thanks so much. Appreciate that.
Mark, any further thoughts, or should we go on to the next person?
Should go on. Thank you.
Thank you. Hans?
Thank you, and thank you for the presentation. Very helpful to understand the intent and the scope generally. I have a couple of questions about where we are, and I believe that Maria might have provided some additional insights there. But on the stage of development of implementation guidance, otherwise, because it sounds like that on the one hand we're talking about a data element, yet in the description and exploring the submission, that could actually be a couple of different data classes, relationships that span the gamut between advanced directive, pulse, PMO, and the structure of how that would sit. Particularly in the FHIR space, there's still some work to be done on how to express and agree to understanding how interventions, intended or not intended, desired or not desired interventions, are to be expressed. So I'm trying to understand a little bit the progression of the need for the guidance needed for HIT that wants to be certified to these capabilities, on what's already there and what still is in development. What should we expect? And therefore, what's really the scope that we are trying to achieve now in version 4 versus what are we looking at in future stages that we need to grow into?
Where is Maria?
We can hold that. Great.
Yeah, but just curious in general, and then we can discuss later further as well.
Holly, do you want to go?
I think you're exactly right, Hans. I think that this is the start of a path. And as we better define and understand GPPs, we will certainly be adding to, I hope, to USCDI.
And Maria has really been the leader in moving GPP into FHIR and making sure that all of the coding is semantically interoperable. And I think what we're going to find, she started off actually with three LOINC codes that represent the questions. You know, what are your, or do you have preferences? And the anticipation was the answers would be text. And I think that is the beginning of the road. And the road ultimately ends with much more discrete value sets that people can choose out of a dropdown rather than have to express with text. So I'm not sure if that helps, Hans, but...
No, that definitely helps, because it is indeed the progression from initial documentation of what could be perhaps text in play, and recognizing that where we want to go is to a place where the documentation is done in such a way, either directly in a computable format or by way of NLP in a computable format, in some fashion that can be utilized. And I think in the discussions, at least that were still happening in Las Vegas, Nevada, or actually Henderson, Nevada, to be more precise, occurred, is that there's a lot of work in that latter part, in that middle and latter part, on how to do that. And that's where I'm trying to understand that we might address it as a question for ONC. And otherwise, what is the initial step to take, and what would that scope be versus what is then over time the growth path? Because jumping to the end goal, that I think we all would agree to, that that's where we need to be, is probably too much for US CDI version 4. But what's a good first step? And it's not clear yet what that first step exactly entails.
I do want to note Maria is here, but trying to connect to audio. So we look forward to her presentation as soon as she's able to be fully with us. There is an interconnectedness between these two presentations, hello. Of course. Oh, hello, Maria's with us. Maria, thank you.
Sorry, it's airport internet and it's silly pants. So I apologize for that.
No apologies. Is it okay, Shelley and Bryant and Grace, to pivot to Maria's presentation? Great. And then we can kind of like, knowing that Terry and Holly are here, it seems like the half past, we can then have a collective conversation. So Maria, thank you so much for joining us. Glad your audio is working, and we look forward to hearing about your work, and carry it away.
Thank you so much. And again, I apologize for any background noise. I definitely wanted to be here for this, to weigh in, and yet I'm on my way to Tampa in a couple of hours. So thank you. So I want to talk a little bit about the US CDI draft V4 Advanced Directive Interoperability Considerations. And if you want to go ahead and go to the next slide, that would be lovely. Thank you. So I am the use case lead and have been the use case lead for this project for about 2.5 years now. When we originally created the implementation guide for STU1, we were focused on person-authored information. And like most projects, you know, you can pick a name and it's just not going to apply to every use case. So we picked a name that was representative of the totality of the content we are seeking to liberate through FHIR. Now, STU1 was person-authored. Those are personal advanced care plans like 5 wishes, my directives, prepare for your care, as well as statutory jurisdictional documents that are advanced directives and are available not only in every state, but even down to a micro level, smaller than that. So we have done an environmental scan, deconstructed all the data, and have created a FHIR IG. Our use cases are to create installer, share, allow someone to query access, allow an individual to update and replace, and then verify that what was pulled back through the query access is the most current version. We are wrapping up the ballot comments and have pivoted and are now looking at STU2, which are those creatures called portable medical orders for life-sustaining treatments. Now, these are practitioner-authored documents, and yet they fall under the same umbrella of advanced healthcare decision documents. in this particular aspect of the project, we deconstructed all 84 instruments that are in use across these United States. Right now, we are a U.S. realm project, but we're getting a lot of pressure to go global. So those are Pulsed, Most, Most, and EMS level DNR. Sometimes they're called DNAR. Sometimes they're called EMS Comfort Care. So we have swept the totality of the jurisdictional documents, and we've learned a lot. Would you please go ahead to the next slide? Thank you so much. So we appreciate, I was on last week and I, you know, we were looking at the data class, advanced directives, and the recommendation under draft B4 is to move it to a data class goals. And I was asking some questions and I loved the response. It's, you know, these are not the only sources of people's goals, preferences, and priorities. And I, you know, I lead the HIT committee as a part of the Moving Forward Coalition along with Terry and Greg. So I get it. That made sense. Your Honor, I rest my case. You know, I'm fine if it lives under data class goals. But what we did want to bring to your attention that is critically important since, you know, the advent of COVID, you know, people learn that when our healthcare system is strained, we're going to deliver the highest possible care in mass quantities. And sometimes what falls to the side is personalization. And so we have a data element called the care experience preference. And just to define it, these are all of those moments, years, months, days, hours, before and after a health crisis or an emergency. Now, how do we reflect the health crisis or emergency decisions? That comes under treatment intervention preference. And so those are values or spiritual or cultural goals, preferences, and priorities that really should inform treatment so as to honor what the person has memorialized. So between those two, you've got what do I need to know in the moment and maybe a little bit before and after. Sorry. Background noise, I apologize. And what are all those things that we can do to deliver that person-centered care? One of the things that I wanted to speak to raise to your consideration is the missing component is the designation of a durable medical power of attorney. Now that is currently at a level one, but when you look at the work that entities like the Uniform Law Commission have undertaken, and the Uniform Law Commission is that national body of legal and care delivery and advanced care plan experts. For the first time in 30 years, the recommended national document as a standard for advanced directives is being updated. And they have put so much focus on the designation of a healthcare agent, durable medical power of attorney, tomato, tomato. They have put so much focus on that aspect of this topic that is the only section that is left to require a witness or a notary because it's such a serious thing. And many people who are reticent to talk about this topic will at least designate somebody to speak for them. So I did want to raise this to your attention. Once I'm done, this is really the last slide. I certainly won't blah, blah, blah at you. I want to have a two-way dialogue, but I wanted to sort of state our point. In the Moving Forward Coalition under D as in dog, you will see the quality of life priorities. And I know Dr. O'Malley and Dr. Miller will speak eloquently to the importance of this data element when it comes to really capturing what enables goal concordant care. So those A and B, love it. It's in draft C4. Please don't stop. Please bring this across the finish line and enable people to have their wishes available for data exchange and accessibility. And then raising data element C to your notice, and then bowing to my coworkers and having Dr. O'Malley and Dr. Miller speak to D. Would you mind very much moving to the last slide? Thank you so much. We do know because, my goodness, we have met with teams of sweat down the line of your back clinicians who fought and are still fighting COVID in the buildings. We have met with experts in the EHR, the clinical care delivery space. I mean, we've covered a lot of ground in 2.5 years. The advanced directive observation that is currently at level 2 is a facilitator. It is the catalyst. You can have all the paper you want. You can have all the documentation you want, even digital, and it's immutable and it's authenticated. But we have to have a catalyst to start the clinical workflow. And so when a clinician observes, yes, I see the documents. Yes, I validated that they're authentic. I can use them to honor what is important in care delivery. This advanced directive observation is the catalyst that starts that workflow. The last item that I wanted to talk about was number two, under the data class orders, there is currently a data element for orders for end-of-life care at level two. We would like to propose that that data element be renamed portable medical orders to make it expansive. There are certain jurisdictions where portable medical orders are appropriate for all patients, not just those who are at end of life, like Maryland, where any medical encounter with an adult indicates that a MOLD be prepared. And so we'd like to be expansive, like some of the work that you guys have done, and ask you to consider that. And then the last data element is advanced directives, and that's at a level two. And in our opinion, we really don't need this anymore. There are linked document types that can indicate the type of document, a living will, a personal advanced care plan, a durable medical power of attorney, and then for those states that bundle, living will plus durable medical power of attorney. So I'm not quite sure that we need that advanced directive data element. So I'm done talking. I will go on mute, and I would be happy to answer any questions in case I've gone too fast.
Maria, thank you so much. You really are the twin to the presentation from Holly and Terry. So thank you. We do have a set of hands raised. And I'm going to start with Shelley.
Thank you, Terry, Holly, and Maria. Great presentations. Being involved in long-term post-acute care for the last 30 years plus, and an active member of the LTPAC HIT Collaborative, representing pharmacists and pharmacy services in this particular arena. For those who are ancillary providers to all care settings, including long-term care settings, having a transitions of care is extremely important to these other types of entities. And many times, pharmacy and other types of ancillary services might not have access to the information, and transitions of care becomes extremely important. And having codified data being exchanged using FHIR resources is extremely important for all of these settings to make sure that we can build a comprehensive care plan for our patients. And the GPP is critical, not only to pharmacy, but to other types of ancillary services, rehab and such. It's important and something that we've worked on the pharmacy side for quite a while in coming up with leveraging the transitions of care for certified health IT to encompass these types of preferences and goals. It's really important for pharmacy. Just as an example, if you have a patient who's refusing antibiotics, we need to know that prior to receiving a prescription for an antibiotic, and being able to build into the care plan, such as the pharmacist's electronic care plan, for this type of exchange. We are working on another type of transitions of care document for including medication-related specific data points that are important, which would include advanced directives and other goals for the patient to ensure that we can work with the care team in a way, because medications are such an important piece, as we know, so are other types of ancillary services that are out there. I'm in full support of the work that Holly, Terry, and Maria are doing and are trying to incorporate that in the work that we're doing in medication-related issues. I'd like to also call out the comments that Michelle Daugherty made for this, and they're great comments. And it's not just about LTPAC. It's about post-acute care interoperability, which is part of the IMPACT Act. And we owe it to our patients, especially the aging population, to make sure that we understand their cognitive and functional status, that we're able to exchange their preferences working in a care team manner. And care planning is an important aspect of transitions of care, because if we don't understand when the person is moving from one setting to another, we're not going to be able to have an appropriate care plan for that patient. So thank you very much. And I'm in full support of moving this forward, and also including the quality portion for preferences. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Shelley. Al?
Thank you. I had a question for Maria, just as kind of a follow-up to a comment you made about about no longer needing advanced directives as a data element or potentially as a USCDI data element. You pointed to one data element in USCDI in the level one, durable medical power of attorney. And my question to you is a data element or a concept like durable medical power of attorney, living will, personal advanced care plan, or advanced directive, is that more of a construction, a structured document, or some other sort of construct rather than a component element? Because your thought about those concepts as either sort of the building blocks or the actual building, and that's important because USCDI is a bunch of building blocks, and not so much the building itself. And I also had a follow up question for Terry and Holly about the power of attorney, the durable medical power of attorney. Maria, if you could address that question.
Yes, sir, I'd love to. So our project framework is provided by MITRE, and MITRE is sponsored by CMS. And so we have had a lot of discussion about these things. And we were told that we should not get bogged down, concerned about a data class. If the data elements make it through to USCDI, one of the versions, it is less important how they're classified than it is to find them there within USCDI. So if there is a data element called advanced directives, how can that play when you've got data elements for the other important components, right? It seems like they'll bump heads, like there will be a convergence that will render a lack of clarity. If the information, regardless of class, is what makes a good care experience for me, what are my treatment intervention preferences? I might be of a particular religious sect and I cannot have blood transfusions, you know, the list goes on. Who do I want to speak for me if I couldn't answer these scary questions, but I have a loved one legally designated who will speak for me? And then quality of life, you know, what makes a good quality of life for me, whether I'm receiving care or not. I see the advanced directive data element as being unnecessary if we move these other data elements through. In fact, I see it rendering a potential lack of clarity. And it may just be my vision, I'll fully confess. I don't see everything and I learn something new every day, but that's the best response I might have for you. And maybe you need to educate me, and I'm way open to that.
No, I appreciate that. And I appreciate that the focus on the essential components of something that's bigger or broader than those preferences. So I appreciate that. And I also...
Oh, I left something off the table. I apologize. Uh-oh. So here's what I learned out. In doing this work for the last 2.5 years, I don't think I could be more intimate with the laws and the clinical standards of practice and how risk management within a hospital sees legality as opposed to clinicians. Well written within almost every state statute is the fact that while an advance directive can be a statutory regulated form, it is also permissible to receive a verbal expression of a person's goals, preferences, and priorities, and that should be documented and honored in many states as seriously as a form would be. And I apologize because you asked that question and I neglected to answer it. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, that's an important thing to realize and to define it as more of a structure rather than even a verbal or a handwritten expression. It could be constraining. It's my take on it is it could be constraining to define that. So I appreciate that additional point. So thank you for that. And I also wanted to ask Polly and Terry. With USCDI, we strive to try and create or add more broadly usable data elements that can be used for more than one purpose. And we've talked about that for some of the proposed data elements within draft V4. But this concept of an agent or proxy, designated agent or proxy, I wondered if Terry or Holly had some thoughts about whether or not agent or proxy could be considered one of the possible choices in a care team member role. We have the data elements that were added to USCDI version 3 include care team members and specifically care team member role, care team member type. And I wondered if that could already be captured as a type of care team member role.
Makes sense to me.
I certainly think it should be. Very, very good point, Al.
Thank you, Al, Holly, Terry, and Maria. I believe, Al, that was your 1-2 question. I believe we're moving on to Bryant.
I have a 3-part question, but I'll try to hone it into just the critical one because we're probably running short on time. Maria, great presentation, and reminded me of lots of our conversations in Henderson. Really excited to see this go to the next step. One of the things that Terry and Holly's presentation concerned me or brought up a question for me is what happens when one of the components of a patient preference conflicts or is at odds with something, especially when it's in the patient's own words and not explicitly encoded, is at odds with something that is encoded in other components of a USCDI data element. Is there a feedback mechanism or any kind of accounting for what to do in those situations? And I'm specifically thinking about, in addition to end of life care, what happens when it's a situation of memory care or behavioral health or mental health crisis care where patients may change their minds on the fly and it becomes a complicated situation when you have multiple sources of truth. Any thoughts or discussion on that? But first of all, I'm super supportive. I'm excited to see this move forward.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Maureen, please. And I can follow.
Oh, okay, great. So I've been throwing some chats out there to you guys too. I will certainly check the FHIR resources to see if we have noted any barriers or limitations within the current set of FHIR resources. I agree. I think care team member with a role equal to healthcare agent or proxy, I think that could work. We want to make sure that it's not lost in translation. But I will certainly create an action item for the MITRE team to look into that very carefully and diligently. When you talk about how can we be sure, you guys know better than anybody in the world This is a heavily fragmented healthcare system. And state registries and repositories are on the rise, still and all. We are building an on-ramp from a paper world to a digital world. Is it possible that in a particular state, and maybe they have a registry and repository for this type of information, is it possible that there are providers that are not connected to the state HIE? They're going to have their own version. We're not going to know about it. Yes. Is it possible that someone's going to cross a border on vacation, come over to a state that doesn't have their documents and can't access it? Yes. So we have made provisions within our FHIR-IG to require that a human readable, I dare say PDF, but my tech team would probably kick me in the shin, that a human readable copy of the document should always accompany the FHIR data bundle. So can we make sure that the most current version in Maryland is also going to be the most current version that's pulled up in California? No, not yet. But isn't our role to build the infrastructure for tomorrow and then to nudge people into dropping the paper and moving to a digital person-centered ecosystem? That's my little rose-colored glasses response.
Maria, thank you so much. I believe maybe your question and answer mimic kind of create a pathway to what Hans might be asking. Hans?
Yeah, thank you, and thank you, Maria, for your overview. And in combination with the discussion earlier by Holly and Terry, and the question that I asked earlier, it is very an area that can range very much between a couple of elements and a variety of data classes and data elements that need to be pulled together across different areas to make this fully functional as intended. And there's a lot of work going on. Where some guides in CCDA are already ready, other ones have just passed ballot, other ones still have to go through it, different aspects. And as you go from looking at the goals, the interventions, some of the other preferences, the living will, they have a varied level of standards and implementation guides developed, agreed to, and adopted. So from that perspective, it's when we look at the proposal for USCDI version 4 and read treatment intervention preference, it could actually span the variety of those data classes and may not be suitable for just goals, but it might be in plan, it might be in intervention or orders. So the question that I have is that what is really the intended first step to start to move in this direction for USCDI version 4, considering that the current state of the variety of CCDA and FHIR implementation guides that would be needed still have some ways to go, are already there, but might not be implemented yet in a wide range. So we have that spectrum there. What's really the first step that you see for USCDI version 4 to be a manageable step and not get too far ahead, but also start to make some progress? Because that's not clear from the discussion and from the proposals, including the submission. What are we trying to do? PMO, POLST, advanced directives, a couple of interventions that we still need to define in FHIR exactly how we express that. Where on the scale are we?
So Hans,
thank you, and I apologize. Go ahead, Terry.
Okay, Maria. So I was going to say, Hans, you know, at the center of all of the things you mentioned, the care plans, advanced directives, treatment preferences, there are the individual's goals, preferences, and priorities. And I think that is the nugget, and that is the starting point. If you're able to clarify and make accessible an individual's goals, preferences, and priorities, then that information will feed plans, treatments, goals, you know, it'll feed everything. So I would, if you wanted a first step for USCDI 4, it would be to establish places for goals, preferences, and priorities to live within USCDI. So.
Okay. And I was just going to put this into the chat. I'll probably still hit send. The group who created the FHIR IGs spent almost 6 months working diligently with the same team who created the CDA IGs for personal advanced care plans and the CCDA Advanced Directive Template. We made sure we were lockstep, same value sets, same general ways of representing content and information, same LOINC codes. Sure, you do it different in CDA than you do FHIR, but we made sure that we were perfectly aligned. They support care experience preference. They support treatment intervention. They support healthcare agent. And we have tried to work very closely to make sure it doesn't matter if you're dropping a CDA or a FHIR bundle. The data is going to be consistent. Just decide what shape you want it to be. So I hope that that was a good answer to your question.
I appreciate that answer. I think there's still some questions open in that space, but then we dive too far in the details. And it's particularly around the preference part and interventions that where some open questions are. Are we ready for that? How far can we go with that? And what is the adoption rate that we currently see in this space to say, yes, it's ready for USCDI version 4? So it's a maturity question that also comes into play.
Yeah, I think my only point is everybody can do a CDA these days. Well, everybody should be able to. So if that's what you can do, these data elements will stand the test of time. When FHIR is more mature, when people are, you know, understanding what the ONC is trying to do, it is going to be an easy step into FHIR. And some receivers will still want CDA. It's the same data sets. It's the same framework. It's the same data elements. We've tried to meet people where they are, perhaps, is the right set of terms.
Thank you so much, Maria. I believe we have at least one more time for one more question before we close this period. And I think, Ricky, you might build off that, given your, in the previous conversation, given your area of focus. Ricky?
Great, thanks so much. I agree with the other comments here that this is really meaningful work, and creating an implementation guide that harmonizes or tries to account for the variety of forms out there is not easy work. So kudos to being able to do that. My question has to do, it does kind of build off Hans's question, which is there, my understanding is that the level of implementation for structured data in this arena within EHRs today is highly variable, but most EHRs and most health systems will still scan in these paper forms when those are made available, whether it comes from EMS or whether it comes from a conversation that the care team has with the individual and they fill it out on the piece of paper. And so I wanted to get your thoughts about whether, as one of the potential first steps here, it would be useful or meaningful to include the Advanced Directive LOINC code as one of the required clinical note types that should be made available, similar to the proposal to add, you know, operative notes that our team discussed earlier, just to for those that have the data as a scanned document in the EHR, that would be made available if present. And that's something that would likely apply to every health system while we work on the more in-depth and rigorous feature to have the structured data come through as goals, preferences, et cetera.
No, I think that's a good question. So we have had Epic and Emma Rose from Athena and some pretty large vendors weighing in and holding our hands through since the birth of this project. And they too have said, I have the free world supply of scan documents. I'm not gonna have this discrete data. So we have made sure in the CDA IG and both FHIR IGs, STU1 and STU2 that we're working on, that you can attach a CDA header with a completely unstructured document. You can, you know, wrap a FHIR document reference around a completely unstructured document. And I think it, so yes, having a clinical note that is advanced directives, golly, why wouldn't you? You're asking the question anyway. All of you have been to the doctor. If you've got any kind of ongoing chronic illness, you know, like I do, hypothyroidism, they always say, do you have an advanced directive? They're going to ask the question. Nobody's going to do this in an electronic world, until it's in USCDI. People will meet regulatory. They will meet market demands. But they're not going to add things voluntarily until the carrot is replaced by a stick. So that's one of the reasons we believe that this will actually prompt more adoption. And there are platforms that do capture discrete interoperable data, but they are the exception, not the rule. I think that's what your point.
Great. Yeah, that's really helpful. And so perhaps it's a conversation that our work group can have. Right now, there are 5 required clinical note types within USCDI. And could this be another that could build off of the existing implementation work that already exists across all EHRs to support the ability to convey clinical notes? And perhaps adding that as the note type could be one step in a broader set of steps that would happen over time, but at least put a stake in the ground that this is really, really important to continue the conversation. And if there are specific LOIN codes that you would recommend, that would be helpful for our group. I know there are at least a couple that I'm aware of, but aligning on which ones are the right ones to make sure we capture this in a standard way would be an important part of that conversation.
Yes, sir. I see them on the back of my eyelids at night when I go to sleep. I absolutely know what there are, and there's only 4 or 5. I did just recently request a new code from Regent Street to encompass mental health directives, which due to the rise in behavioral health concerns is another document type. So yes, if that's the use of advanced directive, then I'm sorry I said I didn't think we needed it. I only know what I know. So that was very helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ricky and Maria. We are at time, so Ike, if you have a brief question, we can. But I do want to respect the time of our guests, Terry and Holly, who specifically said they only had until 11:30. So I want to be careful of their time. Ike?
Yes, I think this is a perfectly valid parking lot kind of a question, because it doesn't really affect the interoperability aspects. But looking at what becomes the source of truth from the patient perspective about creating the information, and it's great to be able to exchange it, but what is the source of truth where a patient is providing or editing this content is a relevant issue. Again, not from the interoperability standpoint, but from an implementation standpoint. You know, do I get to do it at home? Do I have to take time away from my doctor's visit to modify it in my EHR there, et cetera, et cetera? I don't think I'm looking for an answer here and now, but just as a parking lot issue for future conversation.
Thank you so much, Ike. Given time and given that you allowed us to think about that as a parking lot question, I am going to, in the presence of no other questions, I want to take this time to thank Holly and Terry and Maria, again, for your historical engagement in this work and your current, like, Herculean efforts in this space, and for taking the time to come and talk to us all today to expand our knowledge on these critical areas that you are all expert in, so that we can make our best recommendations regarding these data elements. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you all. This is great work you're doing.
All right. I believe now we are pivoting to the next section of our agenda, which is to do the our typical work of going in. It doesn't look like we have officially resolved some of the complexity on the physical activity element. At least it's still blank to me. So what I would like to do is start in the level 2 elements, where there is some actual synergy there, based on one of Grace's comments, which is, I think, the second of the level 2 elements in there. So if we can go to the share drive. And I believe we're starting with Mark's level 2 element first, and then start. And then what we'll do is reintegrate some of those level 4, those draft USID4 elements in our future conversations, again, hoping to center phys activity when we return. This is Hans's email recognizing the the removal of physical activity, which we will address shortly. I believe Al's probably pulling up his version of the shared drive.
Hang on a second. I am sharing the wrong screen. So hang on a second. Let me stop share and reshare. I think this is the right screen. And if you could please direct me to the, I believe this is where we are.
Number.
Oh, wow.
This is entirely correct, right?
Blind squirrel concept. Okay, good.
Sarah, except what I loaded recommendations and so forth. It's there.
Yes. Yeah. I think it is there. I think, again, it seems like physical activity is the one that's missing. So Mark, would you care to lead us in discussion on this level two element you're recommending for inclusion?
Sure. So it's a level two, element. And as we've just heard from the previous presentation, so much fits into what the care plan is. This work group has talked about care plans in previous years, and I'm just recommending that we lift it up for V4. I took a look at the care plan resource, the FHIR resource. It is, and I put some links into the column K. So the first one, the care plan resource, is the one that's actually been proposed for this time, and they sort of self-identify as capturing the basic details. It's an intermediate level of complexity, not the full range. There is other work being done by NIH and AHRQ on the multiple chronic care e-care plan, which I'm actually on the advisory group for that. But this is sort of a beginning point that seems wise to me to meet some important values, I don't see this here. Anyway, care coordination, value-based care, having a care plan is critical. So with that, let me stop in the interest of time.
Any comments? It looks like Shelley has a comment. And I know that Hans had a comment on the share drive too. Shelley?
Yes, totally agree with you, Mark, and also have been involved on the technical expert panel for the MCC care plan, which is really feeds nicely into what Maria was talking about on patient preferences, because there is a patient interactive portion of the care plan also, where we can reconcile some of the areas that need to be reconciled within care plans. Care plans are extremely important. They're extremely important to the pharmacy profession at this time of capturing encounters on medication-related issues and being able to share that with the care team. So totally agree with all your comments, Mark. Thank you.
So this is Clem. I'm still not clear on what we really ended up proposing, CCDA or the FHIR or all of them. It's a little blurry.
And this, Hans, I have effectively the same question. Care plan is a large concept. We already have under patient summary and plan some elements of plan. FHIR, US core CCDA already for the document times, there are care plan components in there. So the question would be, is that what other data? I'm not saying there is not other data, but what's the actual proposal on what's being added? Because care plan is, again, like some other concepts that we discussed today, it's very big and wide. Are we planning to encompass everything or a couple of specific elements? What are we looking at?
Hans, I took it that the submission that's available for us to consider was one that focused on the implementation guide and what's been pulled together there, and excluding what hasn't yet been pulled together there. That's why it noted that it was sort of an intermediate approach to complexity.
So Mark, so there is an existing one that's pulled together. Is that in FHIR or is it in CDA? What world is it in?
It's in FHIR, and that's the link that's in the spreadsheet.
Okay.
But I'm not sure if that, does that answer your question, Hans, or no?
Not fully, because that's the resource. Question is, are you looking at the chronic condition e-care plan and everything in there?
No.
But if they're looking at the care plan resource, that has a lot of attributes and components to it. Are you suggesting that all of them should be supported? And would every HIT system have relevance to that or not, depending on what they're doing? That's where I'm challenged, trying to understand what subset is really of interest, and that can then help understand, is that something reasonably a next step for all the systems that are supposed to support that?
I'm not sure I have a delimited answer to that, Hans, at this point.
But Mark, you tend to pick a sort of a middle of the road, we something get done. Have you got a thought on that along that line for this?
Well, I think the submission was presented as a middle of the road approach, but it's not answering Hans's question and perhaps your question.
Okay.
Yeah, when I go to the submission, then it still leaves a wide space of variability of what should be or could be included. And that makes it hard to then say is that if UCDI care plan is added and it's not specifying the data elements, or it's going to include everything without further review, that what does that translate into that? And is that really too big of a step, given where the variety of systems that would want to or would need to support that, where they're at?
Sarah and Naresh, but can I suggest that maybe we try the small group approach to see if between meetings we can try to figure something out, or whether something can be done.
That sounds wise.
Not begging Shelley's hands up too, Ben, but just throwing that out there, because what we are hearing on these calls is that care planning and a care plan is so important in so many ways, and let's see what we can do.
That sounds fantastic. We certainly have addressed many elements of a care plan in our conversation even today. Shelley?
I put most of my comments in the chat, but I do want to state that the care planning process is an extremely important process. In the independent community pharmacy setting, we've got millions of care plans that are being captured, highly codified with value sets. We do have a version of both CCDA and FHIR Release 4. And I'm not sure if the category belongs in care planning, but care planning is definitely the wave of the future, especially for those ancillary services such as home care, hospice, rehab, pharmacy, are all integral parts of the care team in sharing the care team information. And we've already proved that codified information can be captured within the care plan. And if we focus on some of the sections that we already have, such as health concerns, health status, some of these components fit in. Very similar to what we did with SDOH information as part of the Gravity Project, is it's encompassed in the care plan, just as we're hoping that some of the concepts of PASIO, cognitive functional status, advanced directives, SPLASH, some of these areas can also be incorporated into the care plan. So I'm not sure if care plan needs its own section, but we have to be very careful about making sure that we're capturing those components within the data classes that have been established within USCDI.
This is Steve Eitner. One of the things that I just thought about that kind of fits into the care planning components, but we haven't really addressed, and it's not necessarily in our scope, but I could see future USCDI elements tying to it, is looking at payment source for elements of the care plan, whether that be pre-approval documentation or potential sources of funding or whatever else to kind of bridge, begin to bridge that gap. So one of the things we might want to consider as we're working through this is, what does growth look like of the US CDI? So we're not setting ourselves up or setting future task forces up where things are categorized in a way that are difficult to grow.
Well, this is Clem. So the CARE plan historically has been a narrative. So do we really have a good handle on how to break it into discrete coded structures?
Tapping into Aaron's comment in the chat, the various care plans that different systems support have varying levels of structure. And for USCDI, the question is that what is the common denominator across them that is a reasonable starting point that it, when you start to go beyond just text, what's a reasonable set of data that then are common characteristics of a care plan? And then you have specialty care plan, like the pharmacist care plan or other care plans that are in play that hone in on very specific combinations of data. And if you look at, in a way, the earlier discussion of advanced directives and intervention preferences, you're starting to not necessarily define a care plan in the way that we otherwise might think of it. You're starting to define the goal. What are you trying to achieve? You're starting to define what interventions you do or do not want to have done. So you're starting to build into that as well. So it's in a way a specialty form as well. And I think it is that area. What's really the common core that a care plan should have? And can we get agreement on that as the starting point where specialty type of care plans for different purposes, different contexts, then can continue to build on top of that? That's, I think, where the challenge is that you also will see is that the further you get into some of the specialty areas, maybe not all HIT needs to be able to support that. Currently, still a characteristic of USCDI is that whatever we put in is something that all HIT that needs to be certified, plus other programs, whatever they need to do, but particularly certified HIT must support everything. And that's the other dimension that we need to keep in mind. That's why it's a balancing act of understanding not only the full concept and general idea, no concern there, that's the interest overall, but what specifically we put in that we can ask everybody to support.
And this is Steve again. I think from a structured future, and I'm respecting the idea historically that a care plan may have been more narrative, but as we're looking at greater coordination of care with different actors providing different supports and care elements to it, I would think that down the line, there might be a narrative section, but there also might be more distinct elements or specific tasks, if you will, within that care plan, so that there becomes a way of tracking progress or marking off activities that have been done in support of that care plan, because you're going to be dealing with multiple providers, and it would be good for all parties to know who's undertaken responsibility for a portion of the care plan and what activities have actually occurred in that aspect of the care plan.
Thank you so much, Ike. I want to respect Mark's question, which I think is actually a really important one, that should individuals want to gather and coalesce around a recommended path for documenting this element within the breadth of existing care plan facets that we have already either in level two or draft USCDI V4, I think that that's really important. And so akin to how we coalesced around Labs with Hung and Pooja's gathering people regarding medication, I hear Mark volunteering to gather people to talk about this level two element. That seems like a good disposition at this time, given there's kind of similar definitional requirements. And so Mark, does that sound like a good plan?
It does. If people can drop their names in the chat that they'd like to, like for me to reach out to them, or you know, whatever is the best way, email, I don't care. But yes, let's try to make it happen.
Okay, we can include it in homework as well. Thank
you.
Fantastic. And then it is, I do have to proceed to my webinar for CMS. So I'm going to pass the baton to my colleague Naresh, and we're going to move on to the next level two element, which is, I believe, Grace's element. There is Grace's second level two suggestion is regarding advanced directives, but her first, I think, is actually in operative notes. And Grace is with us today. Grace, do you have a moment to discuss this? And we are very short in public. We are almost a public comment. So maybe a quick introduction, understanding we will need to return to this next meeting.
Absolutely. Thank you, Sarah. Very self-explanatory. We've discussed this previously. I tried to include all references and comments in the spreadsheet. Essentially, in a nutshell, out of all of the information that a patient typically gets from the designated record set that's really available in the EHR or that could be available at point of care, surprisingly, operative notes are not part of the package. So from a patient advocacy standpoint, the operative note is critically important for a patient to have a copy of. It may have information of samples and tissue that may have been collected, which can lead to guiding what pathology samples may be available. And it is necessary for demonstrating medical necessity and a lot of different parameters that patients need to make informed, educated decisions about their care. So I hope that's enough at the moment, trying to be mindful of time.
Thank you, Grace. Any other questions or comments around this? Hans?
Sorry, yeah, thank you. And agreed that operative notes are important. And the question is also in this area, what is the source of that that operative node the systems that need to be there. There is a note that to include all node types as part of the conversation as well, beyond operative nodes, and no disagreement that over time they need to be covered. But it raises that same question of where do we get the clarification that not necessarily all HIT needs to support all document notes and types that are in there. But would in principle, I have no concern with operative note or any other one per se. It goes just back to that general question of how do we manage that? What's the source of the information? Is it the EHR or is it some other system that really where that's being created? Are we setting the right expectations? And it's increasingly getting more challenging with USCDI. So I will sound like a broken record on that a number of times, but that's more the concern than the validity of the document type. All of them are important in the end.
Thank you, Hans, for that. We'll move on to public comment given the time on this. And before we move there, Al, I just saw you unmute. Do you have any final comments?
No, I'm sorry. I accidentally hit the space bar.
Okay. So we'll continue with this element in our next gathering, and I'll just move to public comment section.
All right. We're going to pause our meeting for public comments. If you're on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function, which is located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you're on the phone only, press *9 to raise your hand, and once called upon, press *6 to mute and unmute your line. So let's pause just for a moment to see if any member of the public would like to make a comment. Not seeing any hands raised, Naresh, so I'll turn it back to you. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mike. And there is one comment in the Zoom. I'm not sure if we are addressing that right now, but has the medications administration data element been discussed? So this is a question that came through. All right, apologies. Again, let's move to the next section. Could we go to the next slide, please, Mike? All right, we have the next work group meetings scheduled here with respect to the timelines in here. We are marching towards the April's meeting and final comments to be final recommendations to be pulled together for our next upcoming meetings. And this is going to be our area of focus for March 15th facility information. Next slide, please. And here is a revision of where we are currently. And again, the last slide. I think this is going to be our last slide. I figured out this one. Any other guest speakers should we invite with respect to our existing elements of interest?
This is Clem. When you showed the previous slide, had a number of questions. It wasn't clear at what level of specificity those variables would be specified as, you know, alcohol abuse. There's a number of standard survey instruments. Are we talking at that level? Or are we talking just, oh, do you drink?
Al, is that something you can answer?
Yeah, thanks, Clem. Yeah, the intent of this particular data element is to capture the assessment, typically structured assessment for alcohol use or substance use.
So it'd be a particular questionnaire.
That's not necessarily popular, but something like the audit C.
Yeah, I get it.
MAST. Yeah.
Perfect.
CAGE. Those would be. It's to be able to capture the assessment of, not the
good
condition
good
of.
Thank you, Al. Thank you, Clem. Any other questions or further feedback on guest speakers? If none, we can move to the next slide. And
maybe one comment or question is that as we are getting closer and the creation of the draft final recommendations, when should we start to provide feedback or comment? There is the body of work there, but when do we target to begin the review of that?
Good question, Hans. We will, unless Al, if you have any specific timeline in mind, we will discuss that and definitely get back to you on the timeline on when we should get to that. Before I say that, Al, do you have any other thoughts?
Generally, what we do is within 2 weeks of the due date for the report to the HITECH, we'll start drafting the recommendation letter. So that's going to take the recommendations, all of the recommendations, especially the individual specific recommendations, and compose the letter. So it doesn't mean that we can't make some additional changes in the last 2 weeks, but it'll be, so the end of this month basically is how long the work group has to come up with the bulk of the recommendations, whether it's a recommendation to accept in total draft V4 and add additional data elements or specific qualities of each of those data elements, like use one particular standard or change the definition of things like that. Those are the things that we ought to have almost entirely done by the end of this calendar month.
Thank you, Al. I guess with that, we'll move forward to adjourning this meeting. Mike, any final comments?
I just want to mention that Naresh and Sarah will be doing a update of the work group's activities at tomorrow's HITECH meeting. This is a meeting of the full committee of the HITECH. And so you're welcome to tune into that. There, you can register if you're not already registered by just searching for the HITECH calendar and registering. And other than that, we will see you next Wednesday. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.